Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. For the first time ever, a majority of people don't like their own member of Congress. A new poll this week by the Washington Post and ABC News shows the views of Congress have sunk to new lows, with now 51% of citizens saying they disapprove of the job done by their own member of Congress. While regard for Congress has been low for a while, generally people saw their own member of Congress as different. No longer. Disenchantment with our federal government deepens as Congress struggles to address even the most basic issues, like passing a transportation bill to improve our roads and bridges. What can be done about this? How can we improve the climate in Washington, D.C., and the effectiveness of legislators? Here with us today to help us find solutions to government paralysis is Connie Morella, a moderate Republican who served in the state legislature for 8 years and in the U.S. House of Representatives for 16 years, from 1987 to 2003. She was a popular Republican, repeatedly elected in a Democratic district in Maryland. While in Congress, she sponsored important legislation on domestic violence and women's health, while opposing conservatives on gun control, gay rights, conservation, and other issues. She developed a national reputation as a leading advocate for women, children, and families. She was appointed U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. Currently, she serves as president of the U.S. Association of Former Members of Congress. Ambassador Connie Morella, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you were a moderate Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives, known for your ability to work with Democrats and Republicans to get things done. And it seems to be while you were in Congress, you know, you began, it was functioning reasonably well, and then as you were there, it got increasingly partisan, which has continued on and intensified. So you're an eyewitness there. You know, what happened to cause Congress to become so partisan and dysfunctional?
Well, I don't think there was any one reason, Eleanor. I think there were many reasons that combined, and then with the passage of time, parties seemed to become much more polarized. But, you know, even before I was in Congress, the only way you got things done was to work across the aisle, Democrats working with Republicans, finding common ground like the Civil Rights Act, the Environmental Protection, Clean Water, International Relations, et cetera. The members that we elected were consensus builders. And when I was elected, it was very similar to that. I represented, as you noted, a very competitive district where the majority of my voters were not of the party that I was registered with. And so it was natural, I say natural, but I also wanted to bring people together to know that we wouldn't agree on every issue, but we would try to work out a solution. And I frankly sought Democrats to come on my legislation. It was the first thing I did when I introduced something was to get Democrats on it. And accordingly, the Democrats did the same thing. I was on more legislation. I was at the White House so many times for like reasonable gun control bills for various health issues, violence against women, et cetera. But things have changed. A lot of reasons, you ask me. Well, I guess I could start with that mandated census every 10 years that we do. More and more, if you will trace, every 10 years, there is less in the way of competitive districts. They are now what they call safe districts. Less than 20% of the districts, of the 435 districts, are competitive. So when you have a safe district, by that I mean when the lines were drawn as mandated, they were put in the hands of the people holding office, the governor, the legislature, to draw these lines. So the temptation was ever so great to draw them so that you could have the benefit given to the members of your party. Therefore, you have all these so-called safe districts. That means that if you make it through a primary, you are going to be elected. So the primaries became the new Novembers.
Mm-hmm. And how many, what percentage did you say of the congressional districts are truly competitive now?
Yeah, looking at sort of what Charlie Cook has said in the Cook Report, less than 20% of them.
Oh, my goodness. So that means 80% of the current congressional districts are safe districts, meaning they're going to be clearly Democrat or clearly Republican.
Absolutely. Now, there can be a few exceptions because somebody gets involved in a scandal or plagiarism or whatever it might be. So there are some, or somebody works exceedingly hard in the other party and something happens where they do make it. But generally, looking at the numbers and the consistency of voting, that's the situation. So what do I say to the general public who care? As you mentioned, the feeling about Congress is so very low. I say to them, get your state legislators to pass a resolution to establish a bipartisan commission to do the redistricting. And right now, in 2014, it's not too early because beginning a look at the new census plans is already starting. So they could get them to pass a resolution. They're not going to do it otherwise. So they need to have the mandate to do it. Let them pass this and have this bipartisan commission, which then would have public hearings, so the public will know what's going on before they go to vote and find they're in a different district represented by a different person. Now, some states do that. So I must say there are some that are pretty laudatory in terms of doing it, but not very many do. So that would be number one. Secondly, when you have a safe district and it's not that competitive, you don't have to reach out. So you can stay within your own little area, your own committees, and stay on your side of the platform for your committee meetings, and never get to know the other members of Congress. It is true that when we had pages, and unfortunately the House terminated the page program, there were times when members of Congress would go to the page, this is in the chamber, House chamber, and say, who is that speaking now? They didn't even know their own colleagues, and the pages who had to memorize the members of Congress on their side of the aisle, know where they were from, what they looked like, they would answer. There's something about the need to get to know somebody, to respect them, to listen to them, and then maybe you can work out differences. Those are a couple of the reasons. How do you solve that? Well, it takes both branches of government. It takes the president meeting often with members of the House and the Senate, both parties. It takes the leadership in both the House and the Senate to have bipartisan briefings, to have bipartisan events, to discuss in general. The public want us to work together, so we need to do some demonstration of how we can do this with certain issues. So that's another reason, getting to know each other. Shall I continue?
No, that's great. And, you know, I was just reflecting when you mentioned about this problem where less than 20% of the districts are competitive. So, therefore, that means that in 80% of the districts, you know it's going to be the Democrat will win or the Republican will win. So you said the primary becomes the November, the primary election becomes really determining who's going to win. But I know from having worked in elections or just looking at the election results, not only does that mean that you're going to get Democratic or Republican for sure in, it also means that the candidate chosen by the party is likely to be someone, you know, maybe more extreme in that party, because who shows up to vote in primaries but people who are very engaged and very committed around a party or around an issue? So you're likely to get more extreme members. Would you say that's part of what's happening now?
You have actually hit what I think is critically important, and that is the turnout in primaries. And, I represented Montgomery County, Maryland. It's one of the top counties in the country in terms of revenue. It's one of the top in terms of education. It just reflects supposedly the very highest of quality of life. We had a primary on April 24th. 12.6% of eligible voters showed up to vote.
No. This is Montgomery County. We're talking highly educated, prosperous community.
It was the lowest percentage in the state of Maryland and one of the lowest in the country. Now, I submit, and since Maryland is a blue state, and we talk about blue and red states, blue states being very, very conservative, not just the opposite, blue states being very democratic, then we know that 12.6% determined who is going to be elected in November.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we need to do something about getting people to vote in primaries. Many people will say, oh, yeah, I vote every election. Well, did you vote in the primary? Well, no, right. I did, but I vote every election.
right, exactly. They think November is all that it's about, and also they think the presidential year, every 4 years, is the only election that counts. But we know there's elections every year. They're either, you know, state and local, or then every 2 years, members of Congress get elected. So there's a lot of elections happening and a lot of voters not showing up. But, you know, I think it goes to this point about people feeling, you know, I think it's beyond disinterest. It's reached a level of despair and disgust by a lot of people going, what's the point of voting? Because no matter who we elect, it just seems to keep getting worse, and Congress isn't doing what it needs to be doing. So what message do you have for Americans who have given up on electoral politics?
Well, as a matter of fact, to your point, we are finding that the young people who say, oh, yes, I'm interested in public service, are not interested in running for office or being involved in campaigns in any way. So what you say about disinterest, it is particularly sad if it's hitting our younger people who are going to be our future leaders. Another point, though, in terms of they're not knowing each other, therefore not working together, planning safe districts, is the money bet. These members of Congress, and I submit, they all care about representing their country. They truly do. They just see it in different ways, according to their district. But they're spending a lot of their days raising money. And the political parties have something to say about that, too. Because in addition to raising for their own campaigns, the Republican Party leadership will say, okay, so-and-so, here's your list of corporations and entities to call to raise money for the party. So go over to the Republican National Committee office and make your phone calls. They do the same thing. The Democrats do the same thing. You go to the Democratic National Committee and make your calls, and we will post the amount you bring in. Very often, a committee assignment or something else that you might want may well depend somewhat on the kind of money you raise for your party. Well, this takes time, and this puts money into campaigns and into kind of resembling results sometimes.
All right, that's very concerning. You know, the amount of time that candidates are spending, I think, it's like 5 to 8 hours a day raising money for either your own race or for your party.
Exactly. Even those who don't even have opposition are raising money anyway, and I guess to ward off opposition, but also they're setting up their own political action committees to help others from whom they will have an indebtedness. So the whole money craze. I'm doing a little bit of work with the Fund for the Republic. There are a number of groups out there trying to do something to come up with something that could be done to curtail the kind of money that goes into campaigns. It's going to take a while. Some states, again, have some pretty good legislation. But it'll take a while, but I know the public care about it, and we've got to get them more involved with, we've got to find the solution and how they can help with the solution.
Right. Yeah, that's very concerning. I mean, for many reasons. One is that we have the problem of our elected representatives spend so much of their time on the money chase, and, you know, we're seeing, I don't know the exact number, but it's a huge percentage of the funding for candidates and parties comes from the top 10% who can write those $100 checks or $1,000 checks or more. So it just gives a distorted sense of, for the member of Congress, of, you know, who is their constituency, the voters or the funders, the people who are the donors to their campaigns. So, and then you get into the problem of how is that money spent, and so much of that money is going in to say how bad the other guy is, whoever the other guy is. So you're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars spent on a lot of television ads in particular, just saying how awful this person is and the world will collapse if this person gets elected. So it's really no surprise that the, you know, voters are looking at this and they're watching this war on the airwaves about how bad each of the candidates is. So they just say, you know, well, forget it. It just all sounds awful. And you can see where the downward spiral goes.
Yes, absolutely right. The materials they use are very often distorted. I mean, for instance, for an incumbent, you could look at any piece of legislation, but apple pie and motherhood, and you could find something within that legislation or resolution that you could take out of it and give it the implication of being something nasty, bad, horrendous. It's incredible what's being done, and it's very negative by and large. It's very rare that you find, maybe at the end of a campaign, anything that's an upbeat a commercial that tells about what they plan to do and how they plan to do it. So it's the negative stuff that, again, turns us off. We care about our government, we believe in our government, and we want our government to be positive. So you're right. And that Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court, that was horrendous. I mean,
horrendous. And do you support the Citizens United decision being overturned?
I do, in mm-hmm. whatever way they can do it. They may mm-hmm. have to do it, you know, state by state, but of course I do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is outrageous to say that corporations are people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so whatever we can do it, we may not be able to get a constitutional amendment to do that, but there have got to be some ways of... And I know that groups such as the one I mentioned, Fund for the Republic, are looking at what can be done. So
yes, good. And you know, what do you think, you know, we actually had a guest recently on the show who was working on the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. But you mentioned some of the states have some good legislation around dealing with the money in politics. And obviously the big one is, you know, having the unlimited funds by the corporations is just like opening, you know, so much money coming in from the side on it. But what states do you think have some good legislation that might be model for other states to follow?
Well, actually, let me talk about election reform in terms of looking at a state as an example. And I guess I would turn to California.
Mm-hmm.
What California did is they have... open primaries. We mentioned the primary, and one of the things we didn't mention is that in most states, you can only vote in the primary in the party where you are registered. For instance, as a Republican, I could only ask on June 24th for a Republican ballot. Therefore, I had no opportunity to make any decisions with regard to, let's say, governor, Congress, etc., even though I know that there probably will be a Democrat that would be elected. And in other states like Texas, a Democrat has no opportunity to make a decision in a primary because they have to get that ballot. Now, California has the open primary, and with the open primary, an independent also cannot vote in a primary in most states. An independent could say, I want a Republican ballot, or I want a Democratic ballot. A Democrat could say, I want a Republican ballot. I think that makes a great deal of sense. Now, what they also did, which I am not sure I agree with, they said, okay, let's say you've got six people on your list of candidates for Congress. The top two, regardless of their political party, will be on the ballot in November. Now, that sounds good. It sounds fair. But on the other hand, you are not respecting, you know, in terms of numbers, et cetera, a two-party system. So I still think that maybe you need to have both parties represented on the general election ballot.
Right, and there's another kind of negative side on that California version of the open primary, which is, yes, the top two vote-getters in the primary will be on the ballot in November, but then if you don't make it in the top two by the primary, you're out. So there can be no third party or other person coming with maybe some new ideas, which is how abolition and women's suffrage and a number of others' idea came kind of from the outside.
That's a good point. That's true. And as a matter of fact, California elected Brad Sherman, who ran against Howard Berman. So it became the Sherman-Berman election. Both of them Democrats. Both of them voted similarly when they were in Congress. They both were in Congress. They were both incumbents. So you can find that kind of thing, you know, happening.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned as one of the things we could do about increasing, improving the situation in Congress about members getting to know each other more, and just even having, you know, these bipartisan events or bipartisan briefings or social time. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that's happened as the representatives in the House have gotten more extreme than, you know, moderate Republicans, which you're a moderate Republican, you were able to talk with members from both parties and work very effectively with both parties. But now we see that the, as you say, Republican, moderate Republicans seem beyond endangered and are now almost extinct. So what are some of the factors you think that make moderate Republicans now almost extinct?
Well, I think part of it is the primary election bit. Again, as you suggested, people who definitely get out there to vote in primaries very often feel very strongly about certain issues. Very often they may be issues that are very far to the right, or they may be issues very far to the left. So you do not get your, I want to say moderate, or you do not get a real reflection of how people feel, even in that political party, and so I think that's a major obstacle to having them work together. And so I think, again, I think once they get to know each other, you know, I'm one who believes that traveling abroad, traveling in bipartisan delegations, is good. Members of Congress need to look beyond the United States. We are a global power, and I think they need to know about what's happening in other countries. But also when they travel together, and these trips are very highly organized and orchestrated in terms of meetings and whatever, they do come back with a sense of respect for each other. They'll talk to each other in the corridor, and maybe as a result of the trip, they'll come up with some legislation that they want to introduce that would be then bipartisan. So I think those trips also help, but I think certainly events also, maybe we should encourage members of Congress to live in the Washington, D.C. area so they can bring their families here. If we cannot do that, I think we need to have a plan where Congress is in session for 3 weeks, and then 1 week they're back in their districts with their families. But we need to do something to enable them to know each other and to still, and have their families know the families of the people with whom their representative, their spouse works.
Well, I love your idea of encouraging members to travel abroad, and I always feel somewhat sad if someone is in Congress and going on a trip and they're kind of accused of having some kind of junket or vacation at the taxpayer expense. I, as a taxpayer, am thrilled to know that members of Congress are going to other countries, learning more about what's happening on the ground, firsthand experience. I was surprised to see the other day how few members of Congress even have an active passport. So they can't travel.
I know, it's amazing.
So we need to know about other countries. And as you say, the side benefit of getting to know each other on those trips is wonderful.
Exactly. You know, we haven't mentioned social media, which, you know, is, again, something that constituents have as part of their mechanism or reservoir of power, the whole concept of social media, which is good and bad. It's good because it can promote things easily, more readily than even the emails, you know, when you can do your Facebook and you can tweet and whatever. And on the other hand, it can be dangerous because of lack of verifiability in many instances. But there is no doubt that social media is playing a role now more than it used to. And there's no doubt that the media is attracting those viewers who vote one way in a primary, who have certain stations that they listen to, and they don't listen to the stations where there might be the other side mentioned or defended. I guess I also want to put a plug in for Sandy Day O'Connor. When she left the Supreme Court, she took on as a cause civics education, and she has a group that deals with civic education that she has been promoting very effectively, because it's true. People don't even know, maybe because they're turned off, they don't even know who their representative is in many instances, let alone their state legislator.
Right. There's a huge gap between citizens and elected representatives, and in that gap, a lot of mischief can happen. So I remember I was gathering signatures for an election once, and one of the people I met on the street said, oh, you know, he said, voting, I tried that. That doesn't work. So I looked at it. I was just stunned. I said, well, you know what? Voting is free power. You know, voting is our ability to choose who is representing us, whether it's at the state legislature or the United States Congress. And when you're not voting, you're giving away your power. And
that's absolutely right. And, you know, I really think, as I said before, people who run for Congress really do want to represent their country, and they want to do it well. It's just these factors that we've articulated have distorted their avenue or their journey. And I think that's why I think there's a role for the people also to step up to it and say, we can't have these safe districts anymore. We need to have open primaries. We need to find out what the issues are and not what your political consultant is telling us is going on.
Right. And we need to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Ambassador Connie Morella, President of the U.S. Association of Former Members of Congress, and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Ambassador Connie Morella. We were talking before the break about what it will take to improve Congress so that it can carry on the people's business. And Ambassador Morella, you are now the president of the U.S. Association of Former Members of Congress. And I'm wondering what role can former members of Congress play in improving the climate and effectiveness in Congress?
That's a very good question, Eleanor. Thank you for asking it. Well, first of all, we have a number of programs. One of them is the Congress to Campus program, where we send a Democrat and a Republican former member of Congress to universities that requested to spend 2.5 days in the classroom talking to the students about Congress, also doing a community event in each one of the locales. And these have been very effective ways of letting the students hear it from the inside, knowing that these former members are still political junkies that still have a great love for this first branch of government. Secondly, we work with organizations such as the Bipartisan Policy Center. There is another civility group and Faith in Politics. We work with them in trying to promote programs that will look at the kinds of things that we are touching on. What can help Congress work better? We've also, you know, talked about some of the intricacies, like, getting back to regular order and the filibuster concept. And so we do that. We also work with members of Congress. We have congressional study groups on Europe, on Germany, on Turkey, on Japan, and we're forming one on China. Now, these congressional study groups are with current members of Congress. They're headed by a Democrat and a Republican, co-chairs of each one of them, and on the House side and co-chairs on the Senate side. We have meetings on the Hill with these legislators and officials, public officials from those other countries and their ambassadors. We also have overseas programs. I mean, we, for instance, the German Congressional Study Group is like 31 years old.
Wow.
And so, yeah, we have a group coming in another 2 weeks from the Bundestag that will spend a week with us in Washington. And then next year, we send a group of current legislators over to Germany. And we do that with the others. So in so doing, we are encouraging the knowledge beyond the domestic issues become part of the issues, of course, but beyond being in the chamber to interacting with parliamentarians from other countries and learning more about how the United States can be involved. I mean, right now, TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Partnership Act, and then the TPP on the Pacific side, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. These are big issues that other countries care about and that affect our employment, our security, our stability. So, yeah, so we do a great deal. It's kind of like, I guess it was Yeats, who once said, I'm trying to think of what exactly it was that he said something about, we were there to wind the clock. And now we want to hear it strike. So we don't forget Congress. Mm. They'll have a great deal of affection for it. Speaking of affection, I just wanted to mention that comedians have always looked at Congress and they have been the subject, deservedly or not, the subject of their humor. And, you know, it goes back to Mark Twain, who said something like, suppose you were an idiot. And suppose you were a member of Congress, but I repeat myself. And then, look at our buddy Will Rogers.
Right.
Yeah, Congress is a never-ending source of amusement, amazement, and discouragement. One of my favorite quotes from Will Rogers, I think of the Committee on Oversight, Government Reform and Oversight, actually on which I also serve, where he said, Congress is a place that starts off each day with a prayer and ends with an investigation. Actually, it's true.
That is really good. Well, it just goes to show troubles with Congress did not start recently.
And we love Will Rogers. His statue is just outside the chamber.
Yeah.
And we rub his toe for good luck, so the bronze, shines.
I love Will Rogers. One of his favorite quotes of mine is when he said, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Right, exactly. Exactly, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, we can laugh about it.
Oh, we care. We care about Congress. And yeah, and I think as former members, we have a responsibility to show appreciation and the value of Congress to others, but also to look at what can be done to help reform it. You know, and I think our members, by and large, get involved because they have that in mind. But what can we do? Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, that's really important work, and I salute you for doing that. And I was wondering, you know, in terms of women in Congress, you know, if you think that would make much of a difference, because you saw a rise. When you first arrived in Congress, there weren't that many women there. And then there was a big bump up in 1992 after the Anita Hill hearings. What difference do you think it would make to have more women in Congress?
I think it would make a major difference for the better. When I was elected in 1986, we had 24 women on the House side, two on the Senate side. Let's see, it was Nancy Kassbaum and Barbara Mikulski. That was her first year elected to the Senate. And with the 24, we had almost an even distribution of Democrat to Republican. And then you mentioned 1992, which was the year of the women, where we had 24 new women were all elected during that time. I think women make a big difference. I mean, I say that look at the Senate right now, 20 women, 20%. They're the ones, Susan Collins, Barbara Mikulski, who helped to come to an agreement with regard to, like, the government shutdown and some of the other crises.
Uh-huh.
You know, Lisa Mikulski, they've stood up. They have gone beyond party. They even meet, like, once a month and have dinner together.
Now, that's great.
And on the House side, we have, it's the Women's Policy, Inc., where the women will meet and they discuss issues. And I think it's the most nonpartisan group in Congress is the Women's Caucus. There are issues where they disagree. They don't touch them. They leave them alone. But they're smart enough to know that if there are some issues where we agree, we can make a difference. And I know when I was there, I could look at some major differences that were made because women worked together. And one of them, of course, is the Violence Against Women Act. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not easy to even get it to be looked at on the floor because they thought this is a domestic thing. This shouldn't even be a legislative issue. This belongs in the home. Well, a lot of the violence was happening in the so-called home. And then, of course, reorganizing, adding the human trafficking to it, and then the reorganizing during 2013. That's made a difference. The Office of Research on Women's Health. Women were not even included in clinical trials and protocols until we passed the Office of Research on Women's Health. And there were four of us who were quite instrumental in it, two Democrats and two Republicans representing both houses. We had Olympia Snow and Barbara Mikulski on the Senate side and myself and Pat Schroeder on the House side. And that has made a difference, and they are still moving ahead to make sure that we are looking at women in all of these areas, that we are even using female animals for research. You know, they were using only male rats.
It's amazing, you know, and when I thank you for doing that, because I remember reading about how all the research that had been done on heart attacks, that all the research had been around men. And they never even thought about, well, maybe the symptoms are different for women having a heart attack, which, in fact, they can be.
They are. The women get it later, but they die. It's the number one killer of women.
I mean, right.
And we never even looked at that. HIV/AIDS, you never thought about women mm-hmm. in regard, let alone the various other diseases across the board. Yeah.
So women
have made, and they continue to, when you look also at international relations, when you can assist women with regard to education overseas, keep the violence away from them or reduce the violence against women when you can give them opportunities to learn entrepreneurship and how to get involved in the economy, then you're going to make a big difference in the stability of a country, therefore the security of a country, therefore our foreign aid could be reduced. So it's a win-win proposition.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know, one of the things I wonder about is, what happened that we were making this steady progress about getting more women in office, we got more women in Congress, we had the bump up in 92. It looked like we were kind of on a steady march to, gender equality in politics and government. But then it seemed to all of a sudden stall, and we now just have still only 18% of the federal office holders are women, which means that men still hold over 80% of seats in the U.S. House and Senate. So what do you think happened that made that stall, and what do you think we can do to get more women elected?
Well, first of all, the atmosphere is not one that is very encouraging to women.
Mm-hmm. And more so now even than years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Secondly, no one asks, nobody really will support, you're not going to have everybody asking you to run for office, but when you pose it, to know that there's some element of support that can give you the confidence to know you can do it. So you don't have people promoting the women. You don't have the political parties reaching out to some of the qualified women and saying, hey, let's do affirmative action on getting some really good women to run for office. Not only that, they don't help her after she's, I'm generalizing, of course, but they don't help her. So women are less likely than men to be recruited to run for office. They're less likely than men to have the freedom to reconcile work and family obligations with a political career.
Uh-huh.
They need to do more of that. They're less likely than men to think they're qualified. They have less confidence. And they don't think that there's a fair political environment. Put that all together, and women have a problem also, for instance, in asking for raises. So therefore, they very often think, well, I may not be qualified, so maybe I shouldn't run. Or can I raise this money? When we know that women can raise more money than men, they just lack the confidence to get there, and part of it has to do with the very beginning, nobody encouraging them.
That is an excellent assessment. And as you know, the women from Yale recently formed a network called Yale Women, and we're thinking, what can we do? We're Democrats, Republicans, all over the map politically. So what is it that we could work together on that could improve the situation for women? And what we came up with was a 50-50 campaign, because we noticed this block. When women get to a certain level, we make it to about 20% of the highest levels, whether it's in Congress or in media or in business or in academia, kind of hit the 20%. It's like some kind of invisible ceiling. So we're now in the process of developing a 50-50 campaign for gender parity, and I'm involved in the one trying to get gender parity for politics and government. Do you have any suggestions on action we could take to encourage gender parity in government?
I think, first of all, getting women to rise to the occasion, getting women to believe in themselves and the fact that they should be there. When you say in government, do you mean running for office, or do you mean holding positions? Running for office. Well, I think, again, if a group like your 50-50 group, and they reach out and they develop some women in their area to run for office, whether it's a state legislature or Congress, then I think they should show support. You can't just mentor somebody and then drop them. You've got to continue to support. And the organizations have been very helpful to women. When you think about what Emily's List has done, the Wish List, which unfortunately now is called Republicans for Choice, but used to be Women in the Senate and the House for the Republican side. When you think of the Women's Campaign Fund, when you think of other organizations that help women, they make a big difference because they reach out to their body. They show her that she can do it. So I think we need to say to these non-governmental organizations that care about women, do what the Yale women are doing. Work toward the 50-50. You know, Rutgers has done something like that, too. They had their project 2012, and I was involved in that, where they got some former legislators, state and federal, local, and some other women leaders who were willing to speak to groups about running for office. And I think, you know, I think that's a good thing. If they could go to, let's say, Federation of Government Women in a certain area and say, hey, you know, you're in government here, but think about being involved in campaigns and running for office, or to the business and professional, or to some other group and talk about it, being willing to do that. I think women as role models are very helpful. And I think getting some young women as role models is also helpful, you know, because then they can identify with people who are probably their own age. That doesn't mean older women shouldn't run, because they may be in a very good position because their kids may have been grown and they've been in a job and they have some experience. And yeah, so I just think I think we've got to spread the word. And I think we've got to, you know, I think organizations also that have men in them, I think the business community can well see the value of women in high positions, boards, heading groups. And we're seeing more and more of that now. And we're finding out, too, something we knew, but we're seeing evidence of the fact that when you have women on a board or heading companies, they're more profitable. Why are they more profitable? Well, I guess women and men are different anatomically and the way we see things, and women are less apt to take wild chances, mm-hmm. and men will take greater risks. So I used to say if Lehman Brothers were Lehman Sisters, it would have made a difference. But I don't really mean that. What I really mean is if there were 50-50, if you mm-hmm. had 50% women and 50% men, you have a balance. And when you have a balance, you come out with what's in the best interest of a company and a country. So I say promoting women, having other women and other men also promoting women and showing them they can do it.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and I do agree. I think having more women in there would make a huge difference. The few that are in there are already making a big difference. Imagine if
yes.
we had even more. So we definitely want to work on that. And coming at it from another angle, what about finding common ground for conservatives and liberals? In the Washington Post today, E.J. Dionne has an op-ed where he lays out some issues that Democrats and Republicans could work on together, and he calls it a plain vanilla agenda. So he says, you know, some of the issues that people might work on together would be the earned income tax credit being extended for single childless people, an infrastructure bill to repair the roads and bridges, raising the minimum wage, that kind of thing. Do you think if we could come up with a set of issues like that, that, you know, maybe it could be around a particular set of relatively easy issues, we should be able to build some record of success of working together?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There have been a couple of instances where we've seen the semblance of working together, and we've heralded it. And it isn't that they were such important or big issues. It's just a little bit of agreement coming together, and everybody applauds it because this is what we're yearning to see. Show us that you care enough to work together on some issues. And I think the earned income tax credit is a great opportunity. Obviously, infrastructure affects us all, and the minimum wage, like my state of Maryland, has already raised it, but I think the time has come where, of course, in fact, I did an op-ed on it, hasn't been printed yet, but mm-hmm. on the whole concept of the minimum wage, minimum wage rights that needs to be raised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I think EJ Dionne is right. Try that.
Yeah, we'll see if they can make some progress with that. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, a particular part of you. You have such a distinguished career there in Congress, particularly, and did so many good things. But one of the things of note now that's become relevant is that in 1998, you were, I think, one of four Republicans to oppose all four articles of impeachment against Clinton during the Lewinsky scandal. And why did you vote against impeachment at that time, and what do you think of the current push to impeach President Obama?
Can you imagine being a Republican? And
I cannot. That must have been tough.
Something like that, where people knew where I lived, since I live in the district I represented. People would leave notes at my door. They'd call my kids, who didn't live at home, and tell your mother to vote such and such, whatever. But I felt it was very anguishing, and what my statement basically said, what has been done is perjurious. For instance, he lied, President Clinton lied, but it does not imperil the nation, so let's move on. I still think that was right. I felt he should be sanctioned for it, but I didn't feel that we should terminate government and go through all of that. So that was why, and so I still, you know, I felt I had done the right thing, even though it was not easy, and I felt I could explain it to people who disagreed with me, and hopefully I did, yeah.
Oh, congratulations. Good move on that. And
impeaching President Obama, I'm very much against that. The country doesn't need to go through all of that.
No, you know, what a huge distraction when we really need to deal with jobs and the economy and global climate change and educating our kids and taking care of the baby boomers as we're all getting older here.
Exactly.
Let's focus on the people's business.
And so to spend time trying to develop even some articles of impeachment, I mean, which I don't think are there, we just cannot afford something like that.
And you also cast another courageous vote, or actually a couple of them, and my understanding is that you were the only Republican in the entire Congress to have voted against the use of military force in Iraq, both in 1991 and in 2002. What were you thinking at the time, and how do you feel now about those votes?
I was going to say I wasn't the only Republican to vote with regard to Iraq. But you're right. When you pose it the way you did, to vote against both of them, yes,
right.
I think it was. I hadn't even thought about that before. In terms of the first one, the earlier one, it was basically because we had set a date. I think we had said February 15th or something like that, and I felt you do not operate by setting dates. You can talk about, you know, what you hope to do and plan to do, but you don't set a specific date about that, and so I was unsure of it, and that was basically why I cast that vote. And I think I made a statement like that, that at that particular time, I did not think we should operate under those conditions with the deadline. The second one with regard to Iraq, I'll tell you that I was a resident fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard in 2008 when I left OECD. And at that time, we had the chairman was a former member of Congress who...
I should say we need to wrap up, so if you could just close the thought,
okay.
That would be great.
With regard to Iraq, I felt that we should not be engaging in that alone. We were doing this unilaterally at that particular point, and I thought about the young people who would be brought in to wage a war that we had not fully looked at the consequences ahead of a plan of action. So that was what.
Good for you. And that's all the time we have. Ambassador Connie Morella, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the program and for being such a great host, Eleanor LeCain.
Thank you. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Sprechnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.